Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about home improvement today on the program and taking a look at what you need to consider when planning a major remodel. And a couple of guests for you. Chad Spate back with us. He is the owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's always great to be here. Great to see your face today.
Yeah, it's great to see your face and great to see the face of Christy Weber, who is the project design manager for TDS Design Team of Madison and specializes in residential projects, passive house, net zero, high performance homes. And Christy, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks for having me, Larry.
Well, as we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Are you thinking about doing a big remodel? What questions do you have? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. The home I'm living in right now, we bought it and essentially took it right down to the studs. I don't know. and completely redid it. It's kept a lot of things, floor, you know, the wood flooring and so forth. But it was a kind of a massive undertaking. I guess, Chad, you'd consider that a major home remodel.
Absolutely. And I mean, I remember we've talked before about, you know, some of the things you've done in that home and, you know, taking it down to the studs so that you can update the wiring, update the insulation, properly air seal it, add some things, perhaps some lighting features you didn't have before. Improve the heating and air conditioning systems. I mean, these sorts of changes, when they're all done in a significant part of a home, can constitute a, you know, a whole house renovation. Sometimes it's done in phases, but I know you have completely renovated your home inside and out, and that's something that we often do. We find sometimes that a piecemeal approach can be penny wise and pound foolish. That sometimes it just makes sense to tear out a significant portion of a home, or definitely one room at a time, and update those systems. I know a lot of the homes we work on, and I believe your home as well, is a pre-World War II home. Probably built in the 20s or 30s.
1906.
Oh, okay, right. Your home's even older. So, there are a fair number of homes in the Madison area that are older than the 1940s. And, of course, in many communities around Wisconsin, you have a substantial housing stock that dates back to that period, 1900, up to 1930, a lot of nice old homes, and you can bring them back to life, so to speak, by updating those systems to make them so that they meet the comfort and amenity standards of our 21st century lifestyle while still having the architectural beauty that they originally had when they were built.
Yeah. Christy, do you take on projects? Does your company take on projects like this as well?
Yeah, we definitely do. Some of these are the most fun because you're getting to take a really comprehensive look at the entire house. And, you know, touching on what Chad said about phasing, that can be a really good option for people who have a grand vision but can't necessarily do it all at once. So we also... we'll help people do like a master planning process. So we'll get everything on paper. We'll explore all the options. And then we'll kind of look at it as a whole and say, how is it best broken apart into phases? What makes the most sense? What should we do now? What should we do next? And what is sort of the end goal? So that's really helpful for people too, to kind of be able to see the whole and where they're working towards.
Yeah. Patty on Madison's East Side has something for us to contribute here as well. So let's go there because she went through this process as well. Hi, Patty.
Hello, hello. Oh, this is so exciting. I had the best experience, the most, you know, pretty amazing experience going through a whole house remodel. I moved all my stuff out November 2019 into storage on my own with a little bit of help from strong young people. And then went and found a place, a 3-month apartment with my dog and myself. And, you know, lived on bare necessities. And my whole house was completely renovated down to the studs. So many efficiencies with that, because you can do all the electrical with ease and plumbing and everything else. And they took my dreams and turned them into reality. I decided to stay and live in place. Oh, shush. With the dog. And because I'm only a block or two away from my health clinic, I love my community. You know, I turned my equity and shoved it right back into this house. And it's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, well, Patty, thank you so much for calling. It's, you know, it's one of those for her and for me, as a matter of fact, the process worked well. It certainly wasn't inexpensive by any means, but it worked well. And I think maybe it worked well because we had enough or the right professionals involved in this. And I'm wondering, well, your thoughts on this one. What professionals do you get involved in a project when and when should they come on board? That sort of thing. Christy, you want to start with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, getting a design professional involved as early in the process as possible is really important. You want to be able to have the help of someone who can help you think through all the different alternatives. You know, sometimes people are sitting in their house and they're staring at it and you just kind of keep coming up with the same ideas over and over again. And the help of a design professional can sort of jog that open a little bit and propose, you know, they can help you to propose new ideas and different ways of thinking that you might not have ever thought about before. So as early as possible is a really good idea. I mean, if you're planning to start a whole house remodel, that can be quite a big project and take a lot of time, both in terms of the design process, but also preparing for the construction process. So if you're planning to build or to do a whole house remodel or a large project of that scope and scale, I would say, you know, giving a design professional a call a minimum of a year in advance would be the ideal for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chad, what kinds of questions should homeowners ask when they're deciding on the professionals they're going to use?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Larry, and I'll start by saying that, you know, there are kind of two big picture ways to approach having a professional come in. Christy and I both work at firms that are basically design build firms where we provide the design services as a first step and do the planning for the project as part of that, and then move into actually doing the work. It's also possible to just hire an architect or a designer to help you plan. But then the challenge with that is you might create a design or a plan that you don't know what you're getting into as far as the cost and complexity of it. So when you're working with a design build firm, all those services are provided and they can help guide you to something that you might be able to afford to do. Because they actually know what it costs to do things. So then as far as the questions you ask when hiring someone, you want to know what sort of experience the folks you're talking to have with a particular sort of project that you're doing. For example, some companies really don't get into renovating homes that are built prior to the mid-70s that often have lead contamination and asbestos, other challenges that are going to need to be professionally mitigated. TDS Custom Construction and Chaz Design Build, for example, are both lead-safe certified, and there are a fair number of lead-safe certified companies out there. If your home was built prior to 1977, you're going to need a lead-safe certified company to do that work, to be able to pull a permit. I would always recommend that you talk to past clients of any company that you're thinking about hiring to find out, you know, what was the experience like? How well did they stay on budget? How well did they stay on schedule? And, you know, what is the process going to be like? How long does it take? I would agree with Christy that you, if you're thinking about a significant renovation, you do want to be talking to and hiring a professional a year prior to when you're hoping to do the work. That's a realistic timeline. And often I find that when folks allow a faster timeline to significantly impact their decision-making, you know, there's a reason why some companies are available sooner than others. And, you know, those of us with a lot of care, you know, tend to have a longer waiting period to obtain services. So those, yeah, those would be some of the things that I'd be thinking about.
And on what is a realistic time frame? I suppose it's really hard to know. Here I'm sitting in a 3-story house and a basement, and every floor got remodeled. And, you know, some things came up, like they found out there were no footings on this old house. And so an engineer had to be hired and the basement redone and footings put in properly and so forth. That was just one of those little surprises that we discovered. But and so that, of course, that can extend the time. But what's a normal, or is there a normal time for a whole house remodel? And maybe both, Christy, maybe you could respond.
Sure. And I assume you're talking about the construction period, not necessarily the design period.
Right.
Because we already talked about that. I would say, you know, it really depends on the size and the scope of the remodel and the house. You know, could you do a whole house remodel in 6 months? Potentially, depending on the size and the scope. But if for a house like yours, where you have, you know, 3 floors plus a basement and you're doing a lot of work, it's almost like you're touching everything to the point where you're almost building a new house in a way. So that can mm-hmm. take more time. So something like yours maybe would have taken more like 8 months potentially.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Chad.
Well, and I was just going to add, one of the big variables in that is whether or not the homeowner is going to continue to occupy the house such that, you know, one floor is remodeled while they live in another, and then maybe there's a transition period and they move into the renovated space and the rest of the house is renovated. You know, every project is unique. We find that for most of our clients and the projects that we plan with them, they stay in the home and then we accommodate the fact that they are living there. But that has a cost, and we discuss with them what the advantages might be of finding another place to live, the way our caller Patty pointed out that when she renovated her home, you know, she moved for 3 months into another apartment, and the contractor was then able to proceed without having to worry about every night the fact that a family or someone's going to be having to move around, and you can't leave unsafe conditions. So that's a big factor in the potential timeline and cost.
Mm-hmm. And cost for sure. In my case, we were living in another home, and so we held off on the sale of the other home until we could, you know, reasonably knew exactly when things were going to be ready for us to move, and then moved into the refinished home. Well, we are talking with a couple of experts today: Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, Christy Weber, Project Design Manager for TDS Construction, Custom Construction, I should say, talking about home improvement with them. We started on big projects. We can talk other things as well. Certainly invite you to join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Lee Rayburn, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement today on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, and Christy Weber, Project Design Manager for TDS Custom Construction of Madison. Both work in the Monona, Madison area. Do a lot of work, as a matter of fact, as I see their trucks and so forth around my neighborhood fairly often, as a matter of fact. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mike in Greenbush, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. Well, the old adage back before furnaces was that the kitchen was always the warmest room. And I would like to suggest a simple solution. If at all chance you can get R60 attic insulation, that is the quickest return on investment and the most energy efficient and environmentally efficient to have something up in your attic. People who drive around, look at roofs on after a snowstorm and find out which building still has the snow on it. That will tell you that there's enough attic insulation so the heat isn't rising and melting the snow. The best room to insulate is the bathroom. Nobody wants to wake up and go into a cold bathroom, so you always want to have at least one room, and the bathroom needs to be the warmest, because I don't know about you, but I don't want to wake up for a cold room. Bedrooms are least minimum because you can always add a blanket or two. Kitchens tend to have enough waste heat from cooking, but I just want to make it very simple. If you can get R60 in your attic, minimum R40, but R60, best return on investment and the best thing you can do for saving the planet.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for calling. Well, let's get some comments from our guests on the chat. Maybe start with you.
Sure. Well, those are great comments, and I would simply add that absolutely, when we insulate a home better, that is a great way, one of the best ways to get return on your investment and return on your enjoyment of your living space. And a properly insulated home also has to be thoughtfully air sealed, because insulation alone does not create that comfort and prevent the snow from melting on the roof, as we've all learned the hard way sometimes. You know, just putting insulation there doesn't necessarily air seal the air leaks. And a lot of the insulation that we use is a very effective air filter, but it doesn't stop air from moving. It's also true that moisture management, and in particular having a vapor barrier in the right place, is very important. And as Mike pointed out, a bathroom is a very important room to make comfortable and cozy. And it's also a very moist room. So there, if the vapor barrier is not properly detailed, you can have all sorts of issues down the road. So certainly some homeowners can do these things themselves if they know what the important details are. But then professionals also can be a good partner in this.
Yeah, in my case, it was nice to be able to, because the walls were out, put dense pack insulation through the walls, and then at each level, putting in a foam. I'm forgetting now what that might have been, Christy, but
it's potentially a spray foam insulation around the perimeter
yeah.
of your floor
at each level. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. You were going
to
ask something?
Yeah, I just wanted to second what Chad said about air sealing. It's something like 30 to 50% of our heat loss is actually occurring through air. So it's a really important thing in addition to a lot of insulation in the roof. And I guess I would agree that R60 in the roof would be a worthwhile pursuit. You know, code is R49, but adding just that a little bit more can make a deep impact. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to touch on the bathroom and how important it is because of the moisture that Chad was talking about that's introduced into that space, not just a vapor barrier and insulation, but also making sure that you have proper ventilation in there and that fan is operating correctly, it's cleaned regularly, and perhaps putting it on a timer so that you can walk away and know that it's going to adequately draw that air out of there, but not be on all day while you're at work, so it'll turn off after the timer. And then one more thing to add, if people are interested in adding more insulation to their attic or maybe putting insulation where there isn't any, I do recommend looking at the Focus on Energy program, because there might be some incentives for you to be able to help with the cost of doing that work.
And just identifying where the leaks are. That yeah, focus exactly. on energy, if you get one of their professionals out to do a check, you're going to be surprised. You may well be surprised at where the air leaks are coming from, and not always in the most the place where you might think, for sure. Well, Bill in Caledonia has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Larry. I have a home that I'm considering putting solar panels on.
Yeah.
I have a shingle roof that is in fairly good shape, but it's 15 years old. So my question is, if I put solar panel on the roof and then I need to replace the roof in the next 10 years, does all that have to come off and redone?
A good question. I don't know. Chad, have you had an experience like that?
Well, we haven't had to remove solar panels, but that is what would, in fact, likely have to happen when you replace the roof. And the good news is that, the solar companies, I mean, they can be hired to come and dismantle that solar array and then put it back once the roof is replaced. That is something that will have to happen. And so what I would say and recommend to the caller is, I would talk to the solar companies that you're interviewing and then to roofers to determine if it might make sense to go ahead and put a new roof on the home in conjunction with that solar installation, because solar panels are going to be performing for 20 to 50 years. And while the technology will certainly probably make some significant strides over the next 20 to 50 years, I know I'm planning to be continuing to get power from my solar panels for the next 20 years or so. And when I put them on my commercial building, I just went ahead and decided it was time to upgrade the roof prior to putting all those panels up there. 15 years is almost that point where it's a tough decision, because a roof might last at best 30 years. I could go either way. I would have the roof inspected carefully for sure to make sure that there's not an argument to just go ahead and replace it.
Yeah. Christy, nodding in agreement there a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And what Chad said about inspection is important too, because when you're putting all that extra weight on the roof, it might be that you have to beef up the existing rafters to support that. And then perhaps you want to put new sheathing on because you have the old skip sheathing. So definitely taking a holistic approach to the existing roof to figure out, how it's going to interact with the solar panels is a good idea before making any decisions.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Bill, for calling. John in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I've got a few experiences here that I acquired over 45 years, poking around in old houses and everything, both ones I was living in at the time, or also rental properties that I kind of learned my skills working on them. But I had a couple rules of thumb. Basically, it takes more money, more time, and more expertise to put things together than it did to take them apart. And I've seen places where, people say strip it down to the studs, but maybe you don't really need to do that everywhere. But the house I'm sitting in now was a 3,000 square foot 1886 home, and I was able to get, preserve the plaster and everything, partly because it was so well built, 2x6 old growth lumber, 20 foot long, continuous studs in the walls and the like. I didn't have many cracks to contend with. You have to know what you're starting with. The other house I did was, it was built by an amateur, added on to. I had to tear a lot of stuff out and add beams so that things didn't sag anymore. And one other very important thing you need, if you're going to be doing this yourself, it helps a lot to have a spouse with whom you are secure in your relationship. And it helps a lot if they're out there earning a lot of money. So that you don't have to worry about your budget.
John, thanks for calling. Well, I think his point of know what you're starting with is probably a good one, Chad.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks, John, for that call. That was a very thoughtful contribution to our conversation today, because it is true. I know I speak for not just my company, but I know TDS and a lot of other professional companies that deal with historic renovation. We certainly do not always tear out everything to do a particular project. Every home is unique, and you do want to be thoughtful and assess what is there. And whether it's determining whether a 15-year-old roof should be saved and just worked with, or whether those plaster walls should be torn out and what to do with trim. There's so many decisions to be managed in renovating an old home, and it's so refreshing to hear someone talk about that, because it's true. We do want to be thoughtful and make sure we're not tearing out things that would have been better left in place.
Thank you very much again for calling. Matt in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I have two questions. One, how do you find a builder today, and this would be for new construction, who is well-versed in rafter-type roof? We'd like to have a usable third floor in the home, and it seems like all the builders that we've talked to almost exclusively use trusses now, and it made me personally a little bit nervous. I haven't been able to find a builder that builds homes under $1 million that seems experienced in traditional rafter type roofing. And then the second question is. we would like to have a wood burning stove in our new home. And my uncle has a cabin style where he has the wood stove in the middle of the room, and then it's brick all the way to the ceiling. And that creates a very nice radiant heat throughout the evening. As the fire dies back, the brick continues to release heat until he wakes up in the morning. Is there anything similar to that that could be integrated in a new home, but have a floor, like a second or third floor, but still have that radiant heat?
Well, let's turn to Christy. Christy, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So for the first question, you know, the rafters versus the trusses, I would say that, you know, it's a little bit about what your goals are for the space. What are you going to use the space for? How much space do you need? And, you know, what are the insulation levels you're trying to target? Are they R49 code or above code? Rafters, site-built construction can definitely be an option, but trusses come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and they can be custom designed. There's something called an attic truss that's designed in such a way that it actually does create space for a living area or whatever you have up in your third floor. So I wouldn't discount trusses completely, because there are so many different shapes, things you can do with trusses to make it work for your specific design. We will kind of weigh the options depending on what we're building, what the client's goals are. Sometimes we do site-built roofs with, you know, traditional rafters, whether it be a ridge beam or a ridge board with collar ties. But sometimes we will use trusses, whether they be a sort of a standard flat bottom truss or custom designed to accommodate your space. Anything to add on that, Chad?
No, I think you said it quite well. You know, that's all correct.
Yeah. And Matt's in Madison, so obviously two firms I'm looking at right now are two that will do either, but there are probably others as well.
And then we could also, you know, speak to the whole question about the central hearth that, fireplace and having that masonry structure or whatever it is that's going to retain the warmth and then distribute it through the home. And it's a great question, because it is true that the natural movement of heat and air in a home is to rise through the center and fall down on the edges, on the exterior. Think of it as a fountain almost, where the heat goes up in the middle and then it comes down on the perimeter. And that natural airflow is that's the way we used to build heat distribution in homes with ductwork 100 years ago. But for the last 50 years, we've been doing the opposite of that. We've been taking the heat to the exterior wall and pushing it up onto the windows, where there is heat loss for sure, but we are counteracting that cold air that's falling off of the glass with the heat that's often radiating or blowing from below. And it creates a lot of, friction isn't the word. It creates a lot of basic disturbance with the normal airflow. It's not necessarily a bad thing. The goal is to have even heat, but it is contrary to the way the air and heat would otherwise move in the structure. And so there are actually some builders and some home designs out there that look to exploit that natural central hearth concept. It's still quite unusual in 2021, but I don't know, Christy, if there's any kind of passive house, examples of utilizing that, because I know those are homes that are so energy efficient. And do such a great job of retaining that heat. I'm going to guess that, getting back to a more, central distribution of heat might work well in a space like that. But I'd be curious to hear what you might be able to add.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really like, masonry stoves, wood burners that heat up, things that are thermally massive, and that radiates throughout the house. I mean, I know someone who's had one in their basement, and the rather large chimney went all the way up through the house, and it actually was radiating heat into the rooms. First floor was better because of the open floor plan. Second floor got a little bit less so, just because everything's so divided up, which is why, we have distribution through ductwork in the first place. In passive houses, they hold heat so well. And even in something that's not a passive house, but that's just really well insulated, maybe like your house, Larry, That little bit of heat that you introduce is going to stay there and not escape. So in a passive house with really high levels of thermal insulation, it doesn't take much to heat up the inside of the house. So when I first started doing things like net zero passive house design, you know, I was in the school of thought that we don't want to introduce a wood burning appliance into the house. And I say, I'm still with that on the open air fireplace. I mean, that's just a really good way to introduce lots of heat loss to a house that you just sealed up tight. But sealed combustion wood burners can actually work really well for passive houses or high performance houses, whatever word phrase you want to use to describe them. But you need to be careful about which one you select. You don't want something that's going to overheat the house and then you're opening windows just to cool off. Having the ability to damp it down and make small fires is always a good idea so that you can have more control. And then I think the biggest thing to take away when you're talking about a house like that and introducing a wood burner of some kind is having a direct outside air source. Because sometimes when these houses are buttoned up so tight, although they have a ventilation system for people, it's actually not introducing enough air to get that thing lit up in the first place. So having a dedicated outside air source for that initial start is really helpful from what I've seen in different houses in the upper Midwest, people who've been using those in passive houses and the like.
You know, we were going to talk about passive homes anyway on the show today. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about them. What kinds of changes are usually needed to make a home passive?
Christy. Yeah, so passive house, some people think it's kind of a new thing, but it's actually not. It has a very deeply rooted history here in the upper Midwest and in Canada. You know, we in the 1970s, in response to the energy crisis, we did all sorts of cool things like beefing up our insulation, air sealing a lot better, using the sun's free heat to heat the inside of our homes. And then, of course, looking at things like energy ventilation recovery, energy recovery ventilation, where you are introducing constant filtered fresh air to the inside of the home, but you aren't wasting heat because the air that leaves the house, which is heated already, the heat from that can transfer to the air that's coming into the house. So often you'll see maybe an 85 to 90% recovery on that kind of thing. So all this stuff that got researched and started being implemented back then, the Germans got a hold of it and they really engineered the heck out of this thing that we now call passive house. And it doesn't just apply to houses. It also applies to commercial buildings. And we're seeing a lot more of that exponential growth actually in this country. More with new construction than with anything else. The main principles are the high levels of insulation, great doors and windows, air sealing, natural ventilation, and minimal mechanical systems for heating and cooling. And finally, using passive solar strategies, but not relying on them completely. So let's say you had an existing house. You know, we look at the Near East Side. Not every house is necessarily oriented the way that we want it to for the sun. For example, the house that I'm living in now, my stairwell gets a lot of great sun, the rest of it not so much. So how much heat can I actually get from the sun? So let's say I wanted to do a deep energy retrofit on a house like this. Well, I would take a look at what, you know, my goals are and what I have to work with. And this is kind of a theme now we've been touching on this whole conversation. So I'm not in a historic district, so I don't necessarily have to stay really true to the historic characteristics. So I might, and my siding's not in that great a shape. So I personally might make the choice to remove the siding and add a bunch of insulation to the exterior and then put new siding on. Somebody who's in a historic district and we want to preserve all those beautiful details, we may not do that. We may leave all that alone and we may do something more like what was done to your house, Larry, where we gut the inside and add more insulation on the inside before putting new drywall and a proper air barrier on. you know, the other thing that comes up too is now we're tightening the house and now we are looking at our mechanical systems. So we may end up removing the traditional furnace. We might be looking at something like a heat pump system that is more energy efficient, but runs on electricity. So these are all things that we need to be considering when we're looking at doing a deep energy retrofit on the house. It's not just picking the low hanging fruit anymore. We need to look at it as a whole system.
Yeah, for sure. Chad Spade and Christy Weber are our guests today. Chad Spade owns Chad's Design Build and Christy Weber, project design manager for TDS Custom Construction in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement projects on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Christy Weber, project design manager for TDS Custom Construction. Great to have both of them with us. Our lines are all filled. I think we should, and many emails too. Let's go to the phones. And Katie in Burlington, it's your turn. Hi, Katie.
Yeah, I was just going to add to the solar roof issue where should you replace your roof now or should you wait? I just actually did this year. So what I did was I just replaced the part that where the solar panels were going to be on, and because I probably had 5 years to go or so. And then just to remember that you can include those costs in the cost of the solar system. So when you do your taxes, you get a certain percentage of that paid for by the rebate or the tax rebate.
Oh, very.
Yeah, so let's say I paid $5,000 and I get it. I'm going to just simplify 20%. You get that 20% of the $5,000 because it's not just the solar panels that you get credit for. It's all of the work that goes into preparing the site, too. So that's all the total cost. So in some ways, it was kind of like a kind of a win-win for me because I got a rebate where I will get a tax. I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong words, but a tax credit on my 2020 tax return. But it'll also include part of the roof replacement.
Yeah, that's good information, Katie. Thank you so much for calling. And so maybe our earlier caller could do half the roof or whatever percentage of the roof that he needs and get that redone and get the rebate and go from there. Makes sense.
That's great advice. Great advice. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
thank you, Katie. Appreciate it very much. Sandra in Barrington, I believe. It's your turn.
Hey, good morning. Great show. I had a question about cedar shake roof. Ours is about 32 years old, and we haven't had any leaks. They say 30 to 50 years, but we did have some that we felt we wanted to replace because we're considering solar panels as well. So what do you think about the longevity of the roof?
Sure.
Well, yeah, Chad?
Well, so a lot of times when cedar shakes are put on the roof, a really, high quality underlayment is integrated with that system. And of course, it's whenever you do a roof, no matter what the material, you definitely want to use a quality underlayment because like any good system on a home, there's redundancy. And so it's not just the top layer that's keeping water out. It's the layer below it as well. And together, they keep the house dry and allow it to function and allow the shakes ultimately to last a long time. So I would say that my answer to that question would depend on what was done underneath the shakes when they were installed and to have that inspected to see what condition the whole roof system is in. And if it appears to be in excellent shape, again, there would be a tough choice to make. But as we've said before, you know, with a solar system, at some point you're going to take those off, either to improve that system and with it maybe replace the roof, or do you only address the part of the roof where you are going to have something that obstructs it and makes it harder to repair down the line? You know, I would say I would look at it from a kind of cost benefit analysis, you know, with the different options. The one point that the previous caller made about being able to recapture some of the cost of the roof replacement or roof repairs with the offset that with the tax credit. I mean, that definitely was a great comment. I have to say, honestly, I don't that was news to me. Like I'd not heard that before. Would have to follow up with my accountant. I plan on it. You know, something like that definitely changes the equation.
Yeah. Thank you appreciate it very much. Pete in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Larry and Chad. Hey, Christy. I called earlier wanting to comment on the gentleman with the 15-year-old roof. You know, we live in Wisconsin here, and we listen to Larry's show, and we find that even on a 30-year roof, 15 years in is not that far from end of life. So I would encourage him to look at metal roofing for two reasons. One is that it is so light in weight, especially aluminum shingles, that you're taking off basically as much weight as the solar electric panels are putting on. So it's a wash then as far as meeting that 40-pound per square foot snow load. But the other thing is important too, and it was with the caller who just got off, and that is, you know, things can go wrong on solar electric panels. Those running microinverters have 240 volts AC up on the roof. Other inverters run 350 to 500 volts DC. I would be pretty quick to take the cedar shake off and put a metal roof under there just in case. And there's lots of metal roofing options that look like wood shingles. They're attractive, but I just wouldn't be mixing potentially high voltage electricity and wood shingles. I think that's asking for trouble.
Oh, all right.
Great points.
Yeah, great points. Thank you, Pete. Appreciate it. Charlie in Richfield, your turn. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. We are looking to replace our roof this spring, and we have skylights. So is it a given that you replace the skylights when you replace the shingles? And also, we have snow on our roof right now, but right around the skylights, it's, you know, there's no snow, you know, probably about 6-10 inches out from the skylight.
Yep. Okay. Chad, you want to take a crack to be in here?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so to answer the first question, I would say that the skylights may not need to be replaced, and I would have the roofer inspect them carefully. I would be concerned if any of the glass has, if the seal has failed, then it would be an obvious opportunity to go ahead and update the skylights. But, you know, skylights are not unlike the roof itself. They probably have a 20 to 30 year lifespan to fully perform as we would expect them to. And then once you reach that point, obviously, if you get another few decades out of them without any leaks, then that's great. But the way many quality skylights would be flashed to the roof, it does make it possible to reintegrate them possibly to a new roof. But again, you know, if the skylights themselves are a little, you know, showing signs of significant wear and tear, then it would be an opportunity to replace them. As far as the issue of snow melting around them, that would be a natural occurrence, just the way snow often tends to melt a bit around a building. It has to do with the sun is hitting that skylight. First off, more heat is escaping from the skylight, just like it is from a window or a door, because you have an R value of maybe 4 or 5 compared to an R value of anywhere from 20 to 60 all around it. And so because the heat is escaping there, that's going to migrate a bit around the perimeter of that unit, and it's going to melt the snow. I'm not concerned about that, particularly if there aren't any signs of, water leaking around the skylight. That's just a natural thing that's going to happen.
Yeah. Christy, anything to add there?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Chad pretty much covered it. It depends on how old the skylights are, of course. There are some pretty cool new things going on out there with skylights right now. So it might be that you just want the new cool thing.
So in 30 seconds, tell me an example of a cool thing going on with a skylight.
Well, I like that nowadays you can actually get shades that are integrated into the skylight system. Some of them can be put on like a remote control so that you can open and close the shades. And this to me is really especially important because skylights, they don't have an opportunity for, like a window might have a roof overhang to shield from the really hot summer sun. And that reduces your cooling load in the summer. But a skylight usually doesn't have that situation. So with the introduction of some shades that are on a remote control, you have a little bit more control over how much sun you're letting into the house in the summer.
And you did that in 30 seconds. Good job. We're talking with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Christy Weber of TDS Custom Construction. They'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking home improvement today with Chad Spate. He's the owner of Chad's Design Build of Madison and Monona, and Christy Weber, project design manager for TDS Design Team of Madison. So, what questions do you have? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's take some emails. Kim emailed that she's contemplating a four-season sunroom addition, wondering about the cost estimate and things to consider: temperature control, the windows. Her proposed location is the south side of the home. Lots of sun, good in winter, not as hot as but hot as blazes in the summer. So there you go. What do you think there, Christy Weber?
Well, yeah. I guess my first question would be, when you say four season, does that mean that it's basically just an addition like the rest of the house where it's going to be heated and cooled and fully insulated? So if that is the case, then, I would say tying into the existing heating and cooling system is probably the best way to go. In either case, when you're thinking about the sun and how hot it can be and how much it can actually overheat a space, the simplest and most tried and true method is dealing with the sun using overhangs from your roof. If it's a first floor and you have a second floor above it, so there's no roof overhangs, you can also design decorative elements that use that serve the same function. And, of course, you don't want them so deep that you'll shield the sun in the winter, because you'd like the sun to come in the winter. We're all craving that all winter long. So I usually like to start around 18 to 24 inches for a roof overhang. And there's a tool out there called susdesign.org, I believe, that can kind of help you dial in the correct depth and height of the overhang for your roof to shield it from the sun. If in fact it's a three season porch, the overhang can still do a lot to help you not overheat. But in this case, you might not be introducing mechanical heat into this space, and you would definitely need to be clear to your building code officials that this is a three season room and it's not meant to be used all year long and it won't be heated.
All right. Good advice there. What's the, an addition. Is there any kind of cost per square foot? She was wondering what it costs. And a cost per square foot on a three season versus a four season, I would expect would be a difference for sure.
There might be a little bit different cost just because you're now introducing heat into the space. There is a good report out there. It's called, I can't remember what it's called. I'm sorry, but I've mentioned it on the show in the past. But basically,
cost versus value, the cost versus value report.
I want to say it's the Hanleywood Institute or something like that. So that can help you kind of get the averages on a cost per square foot of very common projects in this region of the country.
All right, there we go. Well, here's an addition. Vern and Boyd called to suggest people use urinals in homes to save water. I have some friends who have three sons, and all the bedrooms were on that level, and they installed urinals for a variety of reasons, I think.
Okay.
It's always
going to come down to if you're flushing the toilet or the urinal every time you use it, which, you could argue is good practice. But if you're doing that, then it's all going to come down to what are the gallons per flush. I know in our own commercial space where we do have a urinal, we recently upgraded the valve to an automatic flush. And, it flushes every time you walk away from it. So
Dana emailed that she has an A-frame, so there's no attic. She's considered thinking about putting rigid foam panels on the top of the roof under the shingles. Have you had any experience with this, Christy? Maybe Chad's go ahead, Christy.
We have done this before. It's not a bad thing to consider, especially in a case like this where you have really limited space within the envelope, or the existing envelope, to put insulation. It kind of depends on the unique situation. But the important thing to remember is usually you already have some sort of roof sheathing on your roof, so you're going to end up putting foam insulation over top of that, and then you're still going to need another layer of sheathing so that you have something to attach your roofing to.
Yeah. Marl in Oneida County emailed that his garage floor is cracked in six large pieces, more or less, like a pie. It's cracked all the way to the edges and heaves about an inch in one spot in the winter. Also, the doors don't work correctly depending on the season. What's the solution or what's the fix when you've got, have some cracks in my garage floor. What are the fixes for that?
I think when you see that much movement and you have, all of that cracking that has already occurred, because the structure itself is bearing on that slab, which I would assume is the case. Unless that's not the case, and I will assume it is because it typically is for a garage, there's really no good way to reconstitute and properly restore that slab without essentially rebuilding the structure. It's just very difficult. You can do some temporary repairs, but because it's moving around every season, the only way to overcome that would be to scrape things away and then put in a proper bed of gravel and other materials below the new slab. And that new slab needs to be, properly designed and reinforced so that it will maintain its integrity and support the building. And whether or not that old garage could somehow be salvaged, that's another question. And I certainly, would entertain that conversation if we were looking at the structure, depending on what condition it's in. But that's a typically we find that the structure itself is beyond repair, as is the slab beneath it. And so at some point, you're just going to start over.
Wow. Yeah, there we go. Well, let's take a call. Ryan in Black River Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. My question is about adding gutters on aluminum soffits. The soffits go in the bottom about 15 degrees, maybe. It's kind of got an inward slope. And what I'm concerned about is getting moisture. If I put in the big gutter spikes, you know, it's going to leave a hole in the aluminum. And then if I get moisture behind it, is that moisture going to be stuck between the aluminum and the wood that's behind the aluminum coating on the soffits, or not the soffits, the fascia boards. And then I don't want it to rot out underneath the aluminum cover.
Sure. So that's a great question. And I think generally, if I understand what you're describing, where the fascia itself is not plumb, it has that angle on it. It's really not appropriate to drive the large gutter nails through the gutter and mount it, you know, right on that surface. Typically, there are metal brackets that our roofing specialists or gutter specialists will install that are there to shim out that gutter to then allow it to be attached, often with screws, with appropriate screws, and that the bracket holds the gutter the proper distance and the proper pitch on the edge of the roof, and still allows it to get under the drip edge, but that just gives you a better overall performance, and it holds the gutter the way it's designed to be oriented on the roof itself. Does that make sense?
That does, but then I shouldn't be worrying about getting moisture through that little hole and collecting. I mean, because there is, like you say, there is the drip edge underneath the shingles, so it shouldn't get too much moisture there, but still I've had moisture problems before, and I'm concerned for the future.
Yeah, well, so, you know, every penetration into that structure, I mean, the aluminum or the metal cladding that's there is obviously designed to keep the water out, and every place that you put a fastener through it is a place that water can travel. So it's just a matter of being thoughtful about where that is put. It is possible to hang a gutter. There are, you know, there is a system that allows you to use strapping and to put the straps up onto the roof itself and then hang the gutter on the edge of the roof. But then the problem with that is you're putting holes through the roof itself rather than through the fascia. And if I were going to pick one or the other, I would put the holes through the fascia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it'll give you a better end result generally.
Good luck, Ryan. Thank you for calling. Kathy in Sabinski. Your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a question in understanding how much ventilation a person should want in their house. We have a home that's 25 years old, and it was built with a whole house ventilation system with an a heat exchanger. And you can activate it in the bathroom, but you can also set a timer to run daily for however many hours you want it to run. And I have no idea what kind of ventilation I should be wanting that system to do for me.
Yeah, good question. Christy?
Yeah, I would suggest if you're willing to do a little bit of experimenting, I would suggest getting a CO2 sensor and also a relative humidity sensor, because the ventilation can actually affect those things. So we like to see, you know, humidity at somewhere in the 30 to 50% range. People have different thoughts about that. Some people like it a little bit more dry. So it's really ends up being like, what feels good to you? If you're at, you know, 35% humidity and you're thinking, you know, that feels good, I don't feel like my airways are drying out, it feels comfortable in the house, then you probably are right where you should be in terms of your ventilation flow. There are HVAC engineers, mechanical engineers that can kind of help you figure out exactly what your total air changes per hour are. But as a general rule of thumb, about 0.3 air changes per hour is typically, you know, where we like to sit.
Yeah, there you go. Kathy, thank you so much. Mike in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question is, I have a single pane window that I would like to take the window out and re-brick. So I would have a solid wall within the living room. Now, I would assume that I would call a masonry to do that. But my question is, could they insulate which I would assume they would do, but once that window and the framing is out, could they blow insulation within that whole wall unit?
So this would basically be, you know, removing the window, and then typically is there a wood framed structure towards the inside of your masonry home?
Yes.
Okay. So typically, you know, it's that wood cavity, the stud cavity, where there's going to be insulation, and then there's a waterproofing that is on the exterior of that. And generally, for a masonry wall to function properly, there needs to be a gap for water to be able to run down the exterior of that wood structure and get out of the masonry wall when it gets saturated. So a mason would do the masonry restoration, but typically a carpenter or contractor is going to build that framed wall to block up where the window was, and then that can definitely be insulated, and then the plaster or drywall be restored on the inside. And the rest of the wall, that would be accessed from the interior on a masonry wall, probably by drilling holes, potentially. They could be dense packed, where the insulation contractor will often drill about a 2-inch hole, and they'll insert a tube and blow in cellulose insulation to insulate those walls. And that is a possibility and what is typically done in an older masonry home. But then there are other details that we might want to consider as well. It's the one caveat I'd give there.
Okay. Thank you, Mike, for that question. Tony in Egg Harbor, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Larry. I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but I'm a 40-year mechanical contractor. Not 40 years old, but I've been a contractor for 40 years. But never really took the time to take my own ventilation seriously. So because of the pandemic, I installed a bipolar UVC generator in my two furnaces, and I can say without hesitation, my allergies have disappeared.
Oh man.
I am allergic to everything airborne, from dogs to hay to grass, and it was a perfect test because I didn't do any other changes to the house. And basically, it's a UVC generator and a bipolar generator, bipolar ionization, which if your guests have background in that, I think it's a really interesting technology. And because of all that, I am now manufacturing commercial air scrubbers for commercial buildings. So I think that there's going to be a lot of good information and products that are going to come out of the pandemic.
Mm.
Yeah,
Tony,
that's a great...
thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead, Chad.
I mean, I'm by no means an expert in this area, but we've certainly, I think, all learned a lot more about, you know, airborne threats during the last 10 months here and how to better, you know, protect, in our case, mostly a workspace, but then also for where we're remodeling, but then also our clients' homes. And I've read a lot of good things about these ionization systems and what they do, because they're essentially conditioning or treating the air, and it's not dependent on filtering the air, though that's what with the UV system, you are the air that goes through the system gets treated with the UV, but the polarization of the air or ionization, is what really helps to combat the transmission of the virus and helps to kill it. So, and other contaminants as well. So that's great news.
Yeah. Christy, you're familiar with as well.
I know just the teeniest bit about it. I know that they're being used more, but the reason I was kind of nodding my head is because, you know, in all of this improvement in our houses, we're thinking about energy efficiency a lot. We're thinking about aesthetics a lot. When I think about, you know, some of the new construction and remodeling that's going on that is done well with good insulation and air tightness and introducing ventilation, we forget that indoor air quality becomes more and more of an issue, and we can all really benefit from that. You know, asthma rates and allergy rates are higher in this country than they were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And as we tighten up our buildings, we need to be making sure to also be ventilating them so that we can breathe constant, filtered, fresh, healthy air every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Tony, for calling. Dennis, you have a quick question.
Yeah, I just heard on the news a little while ago about invisible, obvious things. It's pretty much things we take for granted that we don't think would be threatening. What kind of things should homeowners be aware of that we're probably taking for granted? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, perhaps, Christy, what you just talked about is one of those things.
Yeah, definitely. All the allergens and things that enter our homes, all the materials that we're constantly introducing into our homes. That's why people become more concerned about healthy materials. You know, do they off gas? Do they affect, your breathing and your health? Another thing to look at is combustion, gas combustion in our stoves. And when we don't have proper ventilation for those, sometimes that can cause issues for a person's health inside as well.
Yeah, those are all very good points. And here we are at the end of the show. Chad, Christy, the time has flown by once again. Thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's always great to be here. Great callers today.
Yeah.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, thank you both as well. Thanks, Christy. Chad Spade owns Chad's Design Build. By the way, just by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Chad's Design Build is one of our Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So I wanted to mention that as well. Christy Weber, Project Design Manager for TDS Custom Construction. Don't they do a great job? Chad will be back March 11th for sure to talk with us. And in the meantime, let me tell you that tomorrow, time for Garden Talk. Liz Freemuth is back with us. We'll talk with her about tools for the home gardener, plants, seeds to try this year. She always has some new things to try that I've tried, and they're great. So we'll look forward to Liz Freemuth and the Garden Ho tomorrow. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.